The Electronic Frontier Foundation has worked for more than three decades to defend free speech online, fight illegal surveillance, advocate for users and innovators, and support freedom-enhancing technologies. EFF has fought to clear the way for open-source software, encryption, security research, file sharing, and important new technologies. EFF Executive Director Cindy Kahn and EFF Austin President Kevin Welch joined the Plutopia podcast this time. We discuss EFF's history and their current struggles to defend digital liberties.
I take heart in the idea that, like, you know, we can change course if we want to, and we're starting to see it. You know, in some ways, the extreme moves of the second Trump administration have made a lot of people really recognize that they need to look for other ways. We hear from people all the time at EFF, just the list of people who want security trainings, who want to know how to use encryption, who want to know how to use technologies that stand with them and protect them, has gone way, way up. And it's not just human rights defenders and journalists who are always, you know, the canaries in the coal mine around these things. It's a much wider range of people who want access to technologies that help protect them and that stand with them.
Welcome to the latest episode of the Plutopia News Network podcast, featuring Scoop Sweeney, my partner in crime, and myself, John Lepkoski, and our co-host and contributing editor, Wendy Grossman. Our guests today, we have two guests, which is a little unusual. Cindy Kahn, who is the executive director of EFF, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and Kevin Welch, who is president of EFF Austin, which is the only existing chapter of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, though it's not technically linked, and that's something we can talk about. So welcome, everybody, and welcome especially to our guests, Cindy and Kevin. How are you guys?
Oh, thank you so much for having me on.
Thanks for having me again.
Yeah, it's great to see you. I guess I'll kick this off by asking sort of an inevitable question of how the Trump administration is affecting your work at the Electronic Frontier Foundation.
Well, in a lot of ways, I would say the kind of biggest thing we're doing is we are actually suing the DOGE, the Department of Government Efficiency, specifically on behalf of a couple of big unions around the Privacy Act. So the Office of Personnel Management, which is kind of the HR department for the government. So if you've ever applied for a government job or had a government job, you have information in the Office of Personnel Management, was one of the first agencies that was taken over by some agents from Doge, Elon Musk's little group. They've really never been clear what they are. They're a set of different things, but we have a law in the United States called the Privacy Act that was passed in 1974. The last time a president tried to use executive authority to rifle through government data, those of us who are old enough might remember Nixon had an enemies list. He was trying to target his political enemies by using government data. Congress intervened and created something called the Privacy Act of 1974 that says that if the government collects information from you for one purpose, it has to have a very, very high bar before it can use it for other purposes. And, you know, that bar doesn't mean just letting in and secondarily that it has to have very, very high security around its collection of data. And the actions of the DOGE agents and the Office of Personnel Management giving them essentially, you know, administrative level root access to these government databases full of information about millions of Americans does not meet the standard of the Privacy Act. So that's kind of, you know, front and center. We had several of our privacy lawyers pivot and lead in that litigation. But then across the board, you know, we work on, you know, surveillance at the border. We've done more tracking of surveillance at the border than digital surveillance and of any other organization. Of course, that's a huge issue under the Trump administration. There's a lot of attacks on rule of law. We are, you know, there was an attack on the head of CISA, the government cybersecurity head, a guy named Chris Krebs, who, you know, said that the 2020 election wasn't stolen and was personally targeted by the administration. We're releasing a letter in support of Krebs that we're asking the security community to sign on to, because if we are not committed to truth, you know, we have to tell the truth about security, even if people in power don't like what they're hearing. So we've been, you know, kind of firing on all cylinders across the organization, on the law side, on the tech side, and on the policy side, and on the activism side around this, because, you know, we think the principles of free speech and privacy are important no matter who's in power. I mean, honestly, I kind of have told people, like, EFF has sued the government, you know, starting from 1990, you know, where we started and we were founded, you know, in response to police raids in Austin. And so it's not that this is a new thing for us. It's that some of the attacks are new. But we have always stood up for people's rights vis-a-vis government overreach. It's just that in this particular moment, the kinds of government overreach we're seeing are, you know, significant and across the board and at a different level than some that we've seen before.
Have you been threatened at all by the Trump administration? I hear that they've threatened some of the people who are trying to look into what they're doing.
You know, not specifically and not yet. I hope that doesn't happen. I think we are best positioned as the people who stand up to help others who are threatened. And I would like that to continue. But, you know, we're ready. I don't think we're starry-eyed about that. But I think that we haven't yet come into the crosshairs. And I hope, again, that continues, not just because, you know, obviously I don't want to see any risk to our organization, but because, again, we really are hopefully, you know, people who can stand up for others. And that's hard to do when, you know, when you are yourself targeted, it gets harder.
You know, you mentioned the border, and one of the things that I've been interested to see is that, or unhappy to see, but is that, as you may know, in Britain, Theresa May brought in this whole idea of the hostile environment that extends the border into schools and places, yep. You know, where people who have never been considered border guards are asked to check people's status. And something similar seems to me to being replicated, but by a databases in the U.S. where, yep. You know, all of a sudden the IRS, there's a story at 404 Media about this, that, you know, they've seen this document that says that the ICE wants to bring together these databases that have nothing to, you know, like you say, nothing to do with immigration, yeah. Like IRS data and Social Security Administration and HUD and HHS and all these different government agencies that are supposed to be helping people.
Yep. Yeah. Actually, Trump has an executive order that says this, that all the databases should be combined. So 404 Media found some good stuff around it. But this isn't a secret. The administration is trying to create kind of one database to rule them all. I think the first targets of that are in the immigration context. But I don't think anybody should rest easy and think that, oh, well, this is just about immigrants. And if you're not an immigrant, you're not going to be affected by it. We've seen, you know, we don't know exactly what they're going to do beyond that, but what we've seen so far, like, you know, taking people who they suspect are in the country illegally and putting them on the dead list so that they can't access any, you know, services, government and non-government, right? You know, banks and other things rely on some of this information to decide if somebody you know, can transact with them. You know, so yes, I think it's very dangerous. It's one of the reasons the Privacy Act was passed in the first place, was the recognition about how dangerous this is. So it's not just, you know, the government changing its position. It's the government, you know, ignoring a law that Congress passed. And that's really important to recognize, right? This isn't something that was the Wild West and it was just, you know, a new government comes in and gets to change their mind about strategies that an old government did. This is actually the law of the land. And it raises a lot of questions about, well, you know, how do we deal with a situation in which we've got an executive branch that isn't willing to abide by the laws that the legislative branch passes, and, you know, kind of leaves the judiciary as the only place that can really stand up, you know, that's what we're seeing play out right now. And I do worry. And I think it's a rather naive view of the technical people inside Doge that, you know, like if we just get it all in one database, we could be more efficient. I think there is a story that technologists often tell themselves about that the longer you're around big databases, the less sense that makes, even on a technical level, right? And AI won't magically solve it, right? You know, you don't know what you have. And this is, you know, there's a kind of a, I think, a very naive technical story that these folks are telling the world. I don't know if they're telling themselves as well, that like, this will make things better. I don't think that's true. And I think most people who've been involved in technology and security for any length of time know that that's not true. And that's why we suspect there's other things going on other than just, you know, waste, fraud, and efficiency.
Somebody who's seen the dirty insides of American medical data and how not normalized any of it is. Think we have some unrealistic expectations from Doge about even ignoring the dystopian concerns that this would actually really make life that much more efficient.
So, Kevin, there was just an announcement here in Texas that they're going to do their own Texas version of Doge.
ZFF
Austin following that?
I believe last I checked, that has passed, I believe, where there's going to essentially be an official Texas department, Doge, Department of Government Efficiency, which are, you know, our weird frenemy, sometimes ally, sometimes not, in the ledge, Rep. Capriglione. He's all in on that Doge thing. So, you know, I guess just because he knows what Linux is and how to configure a firewall, that helps him from writing really bad laws, but it has its limits, maybe.
Do they have their own version of Elon Musk?
I don't know. I mean, probably some West Texas Christian oil billionaire. That's usually what they end up being in Texas.
Well, Musk lives in Texas, he's supposed to be spending more time away from Washington. Maybe that's his new job.
I mean, if you believe what I've found online, you can go visit his compound, though I'm sure some scary unmarked people might stop you. He lives right near the Redbud Bridge.
Yeah, I think we're starting to see this idea of state-level doges all around. Again, I think that, you know, it's really problematic. And it's something that we find sometimes in technology where people kind of take ideas that technologists have and then use them to do things that are actually antithetical to what, you know, kind of we want technology to do. And this is another one where, you know, kind of concepts of, you know, using, you know, collections of data to try to figure out where waste is in other systems. Like that's a thing. It can be a useful thing, but what they're doing isn't actually how you would go about it in any way, shape, or form. And I do worry about this going out to the states because it's a very seductive idea that we can, you know, I don't think anybody's under any illusions that we have the most efficient government one could have. So it's a very seductive idea that we could, you know, magically sprinkle technology fairy dust over inefficient systems and make them more efficient. And again, that's where I kind of talk about like the kind of a naivete about how, you know, how these things work and what one might do if one was actually aiming at, you know, modernization and increasing efficiency. I'm a little deep in this because we filed three expert declarations in the Doge case that we had two former government security officials, and then Bruce Schneier, who you might be familiar with, who's kind of an old, very famous security expert, just talking about, like, you know, how this is the wrong way to go about protecting people's data as you think about modernization and efficiency.
It would seem that having a Texas version of Doge would be a problem because most of the Texas government is populated by hardcore conservative Republicans because they've been in power for a very long time. And anyone with any kind of a liberal leaning has long ago been shuffled to the back office or fired. So I would see that being a problem if you're laying off or downsizing a bunch of hardcore Republicans.
Yeah. Well, and I also wonder about, you know, I think Texas has a, you know, a well-earned reputation for really, you know, none of your business, stay out of my business, government. Like, this is my, you know, being able to live your life in the way that you choose to without a lot of external forces telling you what to do seems to me to be kind of, you know, very core to a Texas way of thinking. And what's happening on this side is the exact opposite, right? This is government coming in and telling people what they can do, what they can think, what can, they can see, and targeting them, you know, based upon, you know, we've seen so far stuff around beliefs, stuff around visions. Like, I just, I have a hard time coming to terms with the fact that a lot of the people who really talk about freedom in the kind of traditional, like, we want to live our lives without government control, seem to be embracing a strategy that's about reducing the amount of control that they're going to have over their lives.
Yeah.
Opened that door, the door to that when they, you know, passed the abortion laws that they have here now.
Absolutely.
You know, very intrusive.
Yeah, and I the only way I can really rationalize it, because I admit it doesn't seem to make a lot of sense, is that when they're saying freedom, they're not just meaning freedom of their life the way they want. They actually mean freedom to never have to interact with parts of life that they don't like. That is the only way I've sort of been able to square the circle on how they're not inconsistent. But yeah, when it comes to certain pet issues, the rhetoric goes right out the window with what they pass. Like, I need to check on its status because, oh God, that should not pass. But there was, like, literally a bill that was in committee that, you know, admittedly, even some Republicans were like, no, why are you passing this? But it was, you know, it was under the guise of, like, you know, oh, wait, which one was it? Oh, well, actually, I was conflating two. There's two bad ones. One was like a cell phone privacy thing where, under the guise of emergency situations, it was going to allow cell phone companies to, like, send all your data and location to law enforcement, but it left very vague what an emergency situation was. It was a total end run around the Fourth Amendment. And then there was another one that was why I was thinking of immigration, though, because there was another one that was, like, going to be, like, if your house, like, was on the border here in Texas, it was, like, suspending your privacy rights and, like, letting law enforcement just do stuff in your property. Like, yeah, like, it seems when it comes to certain issues like immigration or trans rights or whatever, suddenly this big concern for government leave me alone, it goes out the window. And I've not been able to have a conversation with somebody on the other side that has ever really helped me reconcile this seeming contradiction.
I think there's another aspect to it, though. The software engineer Ellen Ullman had a book of essays that she published in 1996 called Close to the Machine.
Oh, I love that book.
I do, too. And she talks about the way that databases infect their owners. Yeah. You know, that she never saw somebody with two databases who didn't want to link them together, you know, or they started to build a database to help AIDS patients in the 1980s get all the help they were entitled to. And it started turning into, well, maybe this guy isn't sick enough to have this blanket. Oh, you know, man. And there's something about the fact of the database that, you know, there was a guy she worked for who suddenly started to say, oh, I could use this database to figure out what my secretary does all day. And she'd worked for him for like 25 years, and she'd picked up his children from school. And she was really, you know, he really knew her very well. And yet he couldn't resist the temptation once the database was there.
Yeah, I think there is something seductive about it, right? And this idea that you can do things with data that are somewhat, you know, that somehow you'll magically, the data will help you solve things that you can't solve without it. And that it suddenly becomes the one tool to rule them all. It's like, as if if all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. If what you have is databases, everything looks like data. And then you start thinking you can do far more with it than you actually can. I mean, we're living with that with AI right now, where, you know, people are trying to pretend like a a large learning model can, you know, can and other kinds of systems, which can do really cool things, can do all sorts of things that they absolutely cannot, you know, sentiment analysis, like an AI can decide if you're happy or not, or if you're about to be a thief or not, you know, predicting human behavior based upon these kinds of things. Just to say, like, once the tool is good at one thing, there's this tendency to think it can do all sorts of things, and then it pretty quickly slides into things that are like not good for society.
Yeah, I think it's just it's this idea that the past perfectly predicts the future and that correlations are causations. It's all gussied up to seem very scientific, but as an erstwhile former scientist, I'm like, no, it's actually not scientific at all. I mean, you know, do I hate to pull out the philosophy books, but it's just like, I mean, like, literally Hume talked about this a couple hundred years ago, and already is like, look, sun may have risen 1,000 times, but if you don't actually have an explanation for why it's got to rise tomorrow, it doesn't mean anything. And even then, it's less certain than you often like to contemplate, actually.
There was a review of an AI pin, I think it was at The Verge, called The Bee.
Yes.
And one of the interesting things that she finally noted about walking around with this thing, you know, was that it couldn't capture, you know, it's supposed to capture all your important meetings and summarize them for you and stuff like that. And quite apart from the fact that she said its version of her life was like fan fiction. The other thing was that it couldn't capture unspoken moments. So there would be these very meaningful interchanges between humans that didn't involve speech, that as far as the pin was concerned, didn't exist.
I guess, you know, to go back, something that I did want to raise that came up a little early in the conversation, though, that I think that was a good point, so I want to circle back to it, which is just, I think the thing that actually has really been frustrating me with things like Doge and many of these other things is taking actually nuanced, legitimate discussions and debates, but so simplifying and politicizing them that we actually can't talk about real problems anymore. There is a discussion to be had about how we can leverage modern technology to make our government more efficient and work better for people. There is a real conversation about, like, election security and voting machine security.
Yes.
There's a real conversation around, you know, free speech, including, you know, overly censoriousness on both the right and the left. These are all real debates and conversations to have. But we've gotten to a point where trying to argue for the universal principle gets you attack people saying, oh, so you're worried about, you know, how a voting machine could be hacked, so you must believe the 2020 election was fraudulent. It's like, no, but I'd still like to talk about the dangers of, say, letting people vote online, which, thank God, nobody's proposing that yet. But I think
it's proposed multiple times. We have fought back so many efforts, Kevin.
I meant a latest proposal.
Yeah.
I hadn't yet seen Trump try to propose that.
No, Trump hasn't. It's true. Yeah. But boy, we're seeing it in the States still. So anyway, but yeah, I think you're right about this, that it's hard to have the real debate, and we see real debate get hijacked, right? And then suddenly it's you know,
I hate that I have to, like, you know, if I do want to discuss something like a voting machine, that I have to very queerly do all this social signaling, but don't worry, I'm not one of those people. Or like, anytime I want to talk about real issues around platform and content moderation, I have to be like, but don't worry, I'm not one of those horrible people who thinks you should just be mean to everyone. Like, I just get frustrated we can't actually talk about these issues because just bad actors have so muddied the water at this point.
Yep.
Yeah, it's also politicized and corporatized, and it's become almost impossible to talk about anything without politics coming into it. And there's a whole corporate thing that's going on now. There's the power dynamics that we're living with are so completely unequal now. And at the same time, everybody, you know, potentially has a voice on the internet. You would think that we would be in a much more egalitarian place, but we're not at all. It's kind of crazy.
I mean, Cindy probably has more interesting philosophical thoughts on it. I could speak to technical realities as I've gotten older and wiser and a more seasoned programmer of understanding why the universe on a technical level just doesn't seem to want us to have egalitarian nice things.
Well, it's always a struggle between the forces of repression and the forces of freedom. But we did, do some things around the technology environment that I think have ended up making it harder for us to have kind of the original vision. Now, I'd always want to point out that the rest of the internet still exists. The open source community is big and vibrant, and the decentralized social networks are growing and thriving. So it's but it is still the case that we've let what does Cory Doctorow say? Five big companies sharing screenshots of the other four is a thing he's taken from somebody to talk about. That we allowed several big companies to really use network effects and other kinds of things and the lack of antitrust enforcement to monopolize our internet environment in a way that is, problematic. It's brought in the surveillance business model, which has resulted in all this data being collected by us. That's all the bad news. The good news is this is like 20 years old. Compared to other problems that existed for hundreds and hundreds of years before we took them on, like slavery and things like that. I think this is a 20-year-old problem. So, I take heart in the idea that we can change course if we want to. And we're starting to see it, in some ways the extreme moves of the second Trump administration have made a lot of people really recognize that they need to look for other ways. We hear from people all the time at EFF, just the list of people who want security trainings, who want to know how to use encryption, who want to know how to use technologies that stand with them and protect them has gone way, way up. And it's not just human rights defenders and journalists who are always, the canaries in the coal mine around these things. It's a much wider range of people who want access to technologies that help protect them and that stand with them. So, even as, it feels pretty dark right now, we can see the places where the light is coming through. And I think we need, we really need to help empower people to feel like they're not powerless against this. They don't just have to knuckle under. There are things we can do to help protect ourselves and to stand back and to stand with others who are targeted that can help bring about a change in how our technology is and whether it serves us or vice versa.
When I originally got online early on and got involved with technology, law enforcement seemed to be totally clueless about what was going on. These days, they seem to be just eager to gobble up any technology. We see our police forces and intelligence agencies. They've got drones. They have AI. They have license plate readers. And I don't see any way that this could ever be controlled, certainly not in the Trump administration. What does EFF hope to do? Do to at least curtail the abuses of this kind of technology by law enforcement and intelligence?
Well, I think one of the things that we've done in the last few years is we've really taken local control over law enforcement away. Law enforcement gets this technology through, some of it's federal surplus stuff that comes out of the Defense Department. Some of it is, federal money that lets them buy it. Some of it is, kind of foundations and private support of money who are very pro, trying to get their technology into the cops so that they have their things. Local control, I think, is one of the places where we can really start. There are communities starting to push back against this and saying, we want to have a conversation about whether you put ALPRs in our community or not. And we want local control. Democracy is one of the answers. And we've really ceded a lot of that when it comes to law enforcement. People think that just the more power we give the police, the safer we'll be. I think we're starting to see the dark side of that. And I really want people to feel empowered in their local communities to stand up. We work with communities across the board about ALPRs, automated license plate readers. We work with them about cops having access to basically military equipment and being able to turn that against their own communities. Again, I don't think we're going to have federal support for a while, but we're going to have to focus on the state and local places. But, you know, 'twas ever so at a certain extent, like democracy has got to involve the ability for people to decide, you know, how law enforcement works in their area. I think people become afraid of that, and thinking that like this has been professionalized and that they know better. And I hope that we can continue to make people feel comfortable standing up. I mean, EF Austin has done a lot of good work in this over many, many years. And there are EFA groups across the country that are starting to figure out, okay, what's the thing in our community that we can stand up for? I don't think we can do a top-down approach to try to reining in the police. It's going to have to be bottom-up right now. But we can put the pieces in place and get people empowered to know what's going on in their community and then begin to stand up. And then that's how this stuff grows. It's not, you know, the one weird trick to, you know, rein in the police. It's going to have to be a lot of small things.
My job's so much easier if a rein in the police is this one weird trick. You know, and one thing I'll just say in response to what you said, that I agree cops, you know, want to get their hands on all the latest tech they can. Don't mistake that eagerness with actually understanding how it works at a deep level or competence. One of my favorite moments, probably didn't make me any fans at APD, but at one of our police oversight commissions, whatever, I came in to testify to the commission about during some of the George Floyd protests, the way that or was it the Palestine ones? I can't remember. Anyway, our police department was accused of improperly using military weapons, LRADs, sound cannons, essentially. And what I actually was able to do was because I'm a nerd, I went and found the actual owner's manual for the LRAD involved, and I read it. And turned out I was able to pretty definitively show that despite their claims of lack of misuse, which, by the way, their own officers were potentially injured by this misuse. So anybody who wants to paint it as purely an anti-cop thing, I'm like, well, depending on how you look at it, it's looking out for the officers too. But I pretty definitively showed there are rules about never turn it up to max power if you're closer than this. And the APD lieutenant, who'd literally made a PowerPoint saying how far away they were when they used it, his own PowerPoint proved he'd violated the owner's manual about how it was supposed to be used. I don't think he was anticipating that, because the commission was suddenly like, you know, like, oh, well, let's look at this. And like, I don't know what the ultimate aftermath of it was, but like, you know, that's actually, I think, right there, a good example of how the nerds can really push back, where it's like there's a role for being technically informed, because a lot of these people, they don't know how it works. I mean, you know, when I see, I mean, remember, you know, despite the propaganda around they're all technical gods, you know, I mean, yes, I guess if you consider being a teenage cyber criminal a technical god, Doge had some interesting people. But the reality is they built a website that was both a literal Twitter mirror and had such bad security that you could literally post to its API and update its contents and database in real time. Like, so I don't think we should think just because our enemies are moving fast and they seem powerful, they're not as competent as they want you to believe they are. And that is a place of opportunity for us.
Yep.
Well, here's a question. Cindy, you mentioned EFA, Electronic Frontier Alliance. EFF Austin was originally supposed to be the alpha chapter for the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And then EFF decided not to do chapters. This was in 1992. It was a long time ago.
Yep.
But now there is an Electronic Frontier Alliance. How is EFF working with local organizations? And I know Kevin knows a bit about this too.
Yeah. We decided not to do chapters because we felt like the organization was a little too small to be able to do it. And also we really liked the idea of local groups kind of having ownership of what they were doing. So the EFA is structured very intentionally with, I think, six principles.
Sounds right.
If you agree with the six principles, like, you know, People should be able to repair their, you know, have control of their own devices. They're very pretty high level free speech, privacy kinds of things. Then you can be an EFA member. And what that means is we don't really have a mechanism by which the chapters have to check in with us about what they do or how they do it. As long as they're acting consistent with the principles, they can call themselves an EFA member. And we try to serve as a resource to them to get what they need in order to, yeah, it's five, sorry, six. Oh, no, those are the examples. No, sorry, the principles are a little lower. There we go.
Five,
I was right. So these are the principles. And so what we tried to do is really create a loose affiliation of organizations across the country rather than something that looks like chapters. And then, again, kind of shift the way that people interact with us such that we're the resource for them rather than they're the feeder for us. So we don't ask the groups to pay dues. We don't ask them to do anything that you might see with and other kinds of things. You know, EF Austin has a special place in EFF Austin has a special place in our hearts because, you know, EFF was founded because of some Secret Service raids on Steve Jackson games in Austin and the community that rose up to try to stand with Steve and his company in the Austin area was just so strong that at that time, you know, I think nobody wanted to disband it. Nobody wanted to change it. We just weren't going to go the chapter route. So we circled back. I mean, 15 years later, we created the EFA probably. So, we're really happy to kind of have the whole time the EFF Austin group has been active and involved. And so we were kind of happy that even as we were thinking about what the EFA ought to do and how it ought to work, there were already groups out there. And again, the landmark one being EFF Austin that were doing that, but we had never had a relationship with EFF Austin where we told them what to do or they were accountable to us and we wanted to continue to do that. So that's kind of where the EFA comes from. And I think what we do now is a lot of try to do skill building, information sharing. Again, I think Kevin and the EFF Austin group has done a lot of work kind of helping other groups feel like they can do this and what it looks like and running campaigns. There's a big Electronic Frontiers group in Georgia that has helped defeat some really bad laws around hacking in that state. There are other groups that are really, you know, just more focused on the things that matter to them. There's a bunch of groups that arise out of universities that are really kind of, STEM-focused students who want to really think about how they can use their talents and the things that they're learning towards building a better world. So there's a bunch of different organizations involved with a bunch of different goals, and that's kind of, you know, that was kind of our dream. I strongly am really happy about some of the political action we've seen coming out of some of the groups, and I think the more we nurture this, we help, you know, collectively nurture this network, the more we're going to see. But it's better if it comes out of the groups themselves seeing what's needed on the ground than us kind of sitting in our, you know, San Francisco hub deciding what groups ought to do.
What kind of relation
to that? But were you about to say something?
I was just going to ask about international relationships with groups in other countries like the Open Rights Group in the UK and EDRI across Europe and so on that, you know, that are fellow travelers, shall we say.
Yeah, I mean, those are a little more individual relationships. I mean, the Open Rights Group was started by some good friends of ours, including, you know, Cory Doctorow and Danny O'Brien. Yeah, who was on staff.
I think it was 2006, the particular techie event, and Danny intemperately said that, you know, if it was 100 people promised £5 a month, that he would help it get started. And yep. To his astonishment, they got the 100 people.
Yeah, well, I think that's how Danny does a lot of stuff. So that one, you know, we kind of have close ties. And always have, and we work together when they ask us for support, and we, you know, go back and forth. We're doing a lot of work around encryption and the horrible efforts in the UK to try to undermine encryption. We're working closely with them. EDRI is the European Digital Rights Initiative, and we've worked closely with them for many years as well. And now one of our staffers, Paige Collins, is actually on the board of EDRI. So it's very much in those organizations, a bunch of groups in Latin America as well, through my colleague, Veri Almonte, who's based in Brazil. So, you know, depending on what the organizations need, we tend to do slightly different arrangements. So one of the things we've done in Latin America is a set of reports called Who Has Your Back in the United States. And I cannot do the Spanish pronunciation, but kind of tracking how providers of internet and telecommunications services, what they're doing with the data about you that they have, and what kind of protections they have against giving it to the. That's a really important thing in Latin America. So we help support groups all around Latin America doing their own reports about their own telecommunications agencies. So it's a little less, I would say, organized than the EFA. But we definitely have, you know, relationships all around the world. We'll file amicus briefs or the equivalent in cases when people ask us to. We try to, again, it's a similar approach, which is like, you know, we know that showing up as San Francisco geeks who care about technology and law and freedom might not be well received in a lot of countries in the world, in the same way in a lot of other states. We never want to look like we're carpetbaggers, but we want to stand up with the organizations around the world who are doing this work and give them our expertise when they need it.
This made me think about an early project. Gosh, this was probably like the mid-90s. There was something called the Global Internet Liberty Campaign that was formed by EFF and just pulled together a bunch of people, including EFF Austin and several other organizations. And they were global organizations. And we met regularly. And my recollection is that we wrote letters. We wrote a lot of letters, we wrote a letter to Singapore to tell them that they were being a little too... they were constraining the network, and it should be a free and open network.
Yeah, I think that trying to have that kind of solidarity, and you know, as I think Scoop mentioned, it was kind of a different time then, when a lot of what we had to do was explain technology to government. We needed to have them understand what was actually going on online when they might have been, you know, kind of being told a story by other people, and, you know, and the breadth of the internet and how it actually worked. And we still do a lot of that. We've had to do that in the network neutrality fights. We've had to do it in a bunch of fights. But now things have really, I would say, fundamentally shifted, that there are a lot of people in government and in law enforcement who actually do understand how technology works. They just disagree with us. And so now we have to actually talk a little, we still have to do a lot of explaining. And as Kevin's pointed out, right, like sometimes they really don't understand how things work, and we still do a lot of that. But there's this other piece now where we have people who deeply understand how technology works. And I would say the encryption fights are like this now, where the forces that are pushing to try to repress encryption in the UK understand exactly how encryption works, and they don't like it. And so then we have to talk about the values and why it's important for people to have access to technologies of privacy, not just explaining how they work, but really explaining why standing up for them is consistent with the values of, you know, a free and open and democratic society.
I think, yeah, Cindy correctly points out that, no, it's not like it used to be where nobody on the other side understands the tech. Some of them absolutely do, and they reach fundamentally different conclusions about trade-offs around what makes a safe and open society than we do. Even in the European context, when he was in Austin, time flies, I guess over a year ago at this point, we had a delegation of European members of parliament in Austin that we put together a dinner hosting them in conjunction with a DC think tank who was bringing them. And so got to meet a lot of the MEPs. Unfortunately, didn't get to meet Patrick Breyer, the Pirate Party MEP. He would have been my best choice. But I did get to meet our dear frenemy who Corey's written about so much over the years, Axel Voss, you know. And after Corey wrote so many things back in 2018 when he was behind some European Parliament very bad laws. I forget. It was Article 11 and 13, I think he was heavily pushing. But anyway, I
About
actually
the
meet the
copyright
guy, and
director?
he's a perfectly friendly, nice dude, and he's obviously not stupid. Just fundamentally does not agree with me on certain things around privacy and security. Me, Ed, and Alex at the dinner were kind of all three on wanting him. I almost felt bad for him, but yeah, I guess I would fundamentally say he almost. I wish I could be him because he fundamentally like dismisses some of the risks around encryption backdoors that I do because he fundamentally just doesn't seem to comprehend that government would ever use it for anything other than helping their citizens. And I'm like, I really wish I could live in your world, Axel. That seems very nice.
Yeah, the leaders of many, big nations are always getting together for global conferences, and it would seem like, consider the way conservative governments have been misbehaving lately, it might be worthwhile to have the electronic freedom fighters do their own global conference, if not in person, at least online, because it seems like there needs to be some coordination because our problems here in the United States are not unique. There are problems even worse around the world, and we need to have somebody out there talking about it and trying to make something happen.
Well, the good news is that those convenings actually exist. There's a big one called RightsCon that's put on by our friends at Access Now. It was just in Taiwan in February. There's a big thing called the Global Gathering that's put on by the IFF, Internet Freedom Foundation. I might get my names wrong. So they do exist. I think they are poorly funded. Could use a little support, and a lot of the money that used to support organizations around the world working on internet freedom came either directly or indirectly out of the U.S. government through the State Department and USAID, and so the cuts that the Trump administration is making to those that really are hitting hard in the global internet community. So there's good, there's room for a lot more ability for these organizations to thrive and for them to really work together and coordinate. But we're seeing right now huge, huge cuts to a lot of the organizations around the world in this. So it's an area that I think you're correct that that needs to happen. It was already happening on a small scale, and right now it's really in jeopardy.
I mean, and I guess, just to throw out a little historical thing, but has not happened since the chaos of COVID. But I will say that back in 2019, EFF very generously had an EFA convening that I and Alex went
Yes.
to, basically. And we really would love EFF to do another one at some point soon. I periodically bug people like Rory and others about it, of like, yeah, we want to come back.
Yeah, we would love to do it again. It's definitely on the longer term agenda, like a lot of organizations, EFF is really strong and we have a very strong membership, but we're struggling a little bit right now, and so things like convenings might have to be kicked out a little bit. I mean, if somebody listening who wants to support us to do that again, we would be delighted to try to do it, but I'm not sure we're going to make it into the next fiscal year budget. You caught me at a time when I'm budgeting for EFF for next year, and I think we're a little focused on battening down the hatches for the rough water that we see
Oh,
ahead.
yeah, I imagine number of grants you guys have relied on may not be there at the moment.
Well, we don't take any federal money. We never have. We're two adversaries. As I said, we've sued every single administration since we were founded. That's because that's who we want to be in the world, and that's a little inconsistent from taking direct government money. We've taken a little indirect government money for some of our tech projects, like the Let's Encrypt work, but encrypting the web. But so we're not directly impacted like a lot of organizations are. But a lot of people are rushing to support their community groups that are affected, and that has a ripple on effect for
Less
other
money to
things.
give.
Yeah, and it's, you know, we get it. We're in good shape. We're not going anywhere. We're very strong. But it may be that all the that again, we have to kind of focus a little bit on battening down the hatches for the next year rather than getting to do some of the really important work that's a little, you know, not the central piece of making sure that our team is strong and paid.
Yeah. And, you know, I guess just a sidebar that I did want to say earlier based on something Cindy said, which is just, yes, you know, I do think it's actually been really awesome and quite impressive, the sort of lack of editorial control EFF puts over the EFA. I think it's really, actually, I always explain it to people as peer-to-peer activism, but I do mm-hmm. really think it's a very exciting new form of activism the internet's enabled that is consistent with EFF's values of free speech and free expression. I've always been very impressed by, like, you know, it doesn't happen often, but I think it's actually literally only happened once and around a very controversial subject during COVID. But like, I think like there's only been one time EFF ever had an issue with what we were having as our meetup topic. And note, they didn't say, hey, you can't do that or you're out of the EFA or you must agree exactly how we think on this issue. They just exercised their own right of, well, we're not going to tell you what to do, but we can't promote this the way we normally do because it's at odds with our position. I'm like, well, that's totally fair. And so I really do think it's a pretty striking model. And yeah, you, as long as, you know, it avoids the nerd hacker leftist infighting trap of if we all don't agree 100%, well, then you're excommunicated. You've seen some of the flame wars on Mastodon. People can get quite vicious on some of these topics. So I think EFF's been pretty smart with how they've handled this. As far as I know, I think the only group who ever actually got the ban hammer was Free Software Foundation because they wouldn't repudiate Stallman. Other than that, I'm not aware of anything that has ever caused issues. I think it's a great model.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with the details around the Free Software Foundation, so
you
I don't
could
really
talk to Nash about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I don't really want to comment, but I don't think we ever asked anybody to repudiate. Anyone,
I don't know.
But, yeah.
You'd have to talk to Nash, and I don't mean to put you in an awkward internal spot. Or
if
something.
If it, I can't imagine that this is useful to know. But I had lunch with him this week, last week.
Stallman?
With Richard?
Yes, he was in London.
Oh, I bet that was fun.
I hope he's feeling better. I know that he's been.
He seems
doubling.
Fragile, but yeah, he said his cancer is in remission. So.
Oh, that's good news. That's good news. Again,
that is good news.
It's hard when people who do really amazing things also do pretty awful things and how you navigate that. I think like people all around the world were very worried when we heard that he had been ill, and I'm very glad to hear that it's in remission.
He was one of the few people wearing a mask, mm-hmm. you know, and he's being very careful with himself, but mm-hmm. he seems okay.
Yeah, these topics are complicated because, I mean, yeah, without him, we arguably wouldn't have Linux. His work was invaluable in giving Linus what he needed. And then there's other stuff. It's complicated.
The people are complicated.
Yeah, I'm really happy, though, that our community has reached the point where we kind of say that, you know, just because you're a genius doesn't mean that you get to be, you know, abusive to others. And I think there was a time in which we kind of gave a lot of space for that, that if somebody was really a genius and they did really good things and we let their personal behavior towards others, you know, kind of get a pass that the rest of us wouldn't have. And I just don't think that that's right. I don't think it was ever right.
But he does good work should not be in.
Right.
Basic kindness and treating other people with respect has to be the table stakes for participating in anything that's going to build power together. And, you know, again, I think as a community, we didn't hold ourselves to that. We kind of made excuses for really bad behavior that hurt people and drove people out of our movement. And I think I really appreciate that we've kind of come to a new space in terms of that, because it's okay. You can be a genius and a nice person. Like that's not, that's not impossible, and that's that's fair to require of people. And I get that times changed, and that there was a time where we made excuses for that. But I really appreciate, as a woman who's been in tech, and Wendy as well, like, we're kind of OG women in tech. We've seen a lot of stuff that was pretty rotten. Drive a lot of people out of the movement who should have been a part of it. And now I'm hoping we can grow a bigger movement that'll have more power, because it's not so self-selecting by the people who can tolerate, you know, shitty behavior.
I think it's important work. You know, at EFF Austin, I've actually been very conscious about, we used to, around when I joined, with one exception, we basically had kind of all male boards over the years, and we're close to gender parity now, actually.
That's
and so
great.
I think it's important, inclusive work. But you're right, it gets tricky too, because, you know, inclusivity and intersectionality is a complex topic where it's like, you want to have a welcoming space for the neurodivergent hackers who've often been bread and butter of the movement, who at the same time, those people often can intentionally or unintentionally do things that make female presenting people uncomfortable in our spaces. And I sometimes at my meetups, I'm going like, has this crossed the line, and do I got to say something? I think also, because we all genuinely do really so much believe in free speech as a value, we're always debating, one, where the line is. But also, though, I think I'm happy to see that the movement, similar to, you know, the debates around content moderation and whatnot, I think I'm happy to see people get a more nuanced thing. We're, one, understanding that criticism is not necessarily silencing. It's often more speech. So it's not a bad thing when we tell other people that there's actually been a problem with what they're doing. But I've always kind of put it to people, it's understanding that there's everything is contextual, where, like, the way I always put it to people, where they suddenly get it, where I'm just like, well, would you feel terribly free if in your own home you couldn't ask a house guest to leave if their conduct crossed certain lines for you? That's your home, you know? And so I think it's understanding that these, as I always tell people, the First Amendment is actually, and free speech, are not simple issues. They're very complicated. And I think a lot of the bad actors, more on the right, but some on the left, try to act like it's really simple. And, you know, it gets complicated very quickly.
Well, this is funny. I've been sitting here patiently waiting to ask a question, and you just answered it.
Oh.
Well, you kind of answered it. I mean, I just kind of wondering about, I mean, EFF is traditionally, Bennett has defended free speech and has been somewhat close to free speech absolutist.
But real ones, I would argue, not bad actor ones.
But we're in an era where there's so much misinformation and so much radical craziness that, you know, it kind of challenges the strong belief in free speech, I think. You know, sometimes you want to just tell people to shut up.
Well, I get that. And believe me, I have that impulse as well. But I think that, you know, the thing that we're always trying to talk about is, you know, who has the power to shut up who, right? And once you create that power and you put it in the hands of people you like, you cannot guarantee it's going to stay in the hands of the people you like. And so, you know, the point about free speech isn't that people always say nice things to each other. They don't. And it isn't that speech can't do harms. I don't believe sticks and stones can break my bones, but words can never hurt me. You know, that thing we learned as kids, words can really hurt. The question is, who do we give the power to censor to, and under what terms? And, you know, I hope that we're living in a time where we're seeing the people who flew under the banner of free speech and speech for themselves, now that they have the power to censor, they're doing it. They're taking books out of libraries. They're burning books. They're making people take their free speech, what they put on their website about what they do and the values that they believe in, and telling them that they have to change what they say about their values and their beliefs. It's never been, I think, for a lot of the people who have flew under the banner of free speech, about free speech as a concept. It's about my ability to say whatever the hell I want and to shut you up. And we're seeing the shut you up part of it really clearly now, with the government in different hands than it was before. That doesn't mean, you know, we oppose the Biden administration on some of the job owning cases, some of the things that they did around efforts to try to control social media moderation probably did step over the line, not nearly as much as as some of their attackers said, but like those were kind of foot faults over the line, as opposed to what we're seeing now, which is Mack trucks driving way over the line. And so it's hard because people are thinking about the awful things that they're seeing online, misinformation, disinformation, and we're trying to have a conversation about, well, what are the answers that you're proposing? And are those answers going to do what you want and not do other things? And that's a very frustrating place to be in when you just want to shut people up. But, you know, when you live in the law world of law and policy, you know that just because you create a hammer and you put it in one person's hands doesn't mean it's going to stay in that person's hands.
Yeah. Kevin, I think you may have outed EFF Austin as practicing DEI. So Big Brother may be listening.
Uh-oh.
I mean, we will never apologize for that. They're welcome to sue us because we believe excellence is found everywhere. But, you know, I think, I think Cindy's absolutely right that, like, the Twitter files is another example of one of these things that got so overly politicized that there were a few places the Biden administration was doing some dancing on the line, troublesome stuff, but people like Taibbi so misrepresented what was in there and did such bad faith journalism around it that, yet again, you can't have the real debate because you always have to be like, but this part's crazy and I don't believe that. I think it really is. Free speech is about empowering communities to set their own norms and standards without giving any community or any group the power to set those for other communities. So I think a good way to illustrate that is, like, it's not at all problematic, in my view, and actually a good thing, if, say, you have given an online community whose members are predominantly African American, you've given them the ability to, in their own community, say, no, this is our space. We don't want to deal with racism right now, and this is a community norm, and giving them the power to enforce their community norm. This actually promotes speech that might otherwise get stifled if everything was just a melange all mixed together. On the other hand, giving some big, powerful government committee the ability to say what can or can't be said in each individual community, that's when you start getting into problematic territory, whether it's promoting right think on the right or the left. That's when it starts getting dangerous, I think.
So I hate to say this, but we have reached the end of the hour.
Oh, well, this went
by. I feel like we could
talk
for hours and hours. Yeah, it absolutely did. I hope you'll come back, Cindy, and join us again. And Kevin, I know you will.
But thank you so much for having me come on. I'd be delighted to come back. This was a great fun.
Thank you.
That'd be great. I definitely want to mention that, and I flashed it a minute ago for people who are seeing this on YouTube, but there's a place at EFF.org to donate to that organization. And if you go to EFFAustin.org, I think it's right up on the front page where you can donate. And I strongly encourage people to donate to both organizations.
Well, thank you. We work for tips.
Scoop, are you going to say something?
I was going to say goodbye and good luck.
Thank you.
Okay, well, thanks so much.
Take care. Thanks, everybody.
And we will see you soon.
You can stay in touch with Plutopia at plutopia.io. On Facebook, look for at Plutopia News. On Twitter, it's at Plutopia. This is the Plutopia News Network, 20 minutes into the future.